10 days away from spring, and it's time to figure out what to do with the garden. Maybe you're one of those already starting plants indoors, or maybe you're ordering seeds, or maybe you're considering your very first garden. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. You've come to the right place. Our phone number, statewide, toll-free, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage, 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Even the White House has a kitchen garden, and that's the subject today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So it's not long after the Iditarod show that we get to do the annual Botanical Garden Show. And it's always a pleasure because the Alaska Botanical Garden has established an incredible track record of bringing up garden people as celebrity guests. And that's what we're going to have coming up later this week for their garden conference. The garden conference has also grown to the point where it has outgrown its venue at the lovely University of Alaska Anchorage Consortium Library and is moving down to larger quarters at the Hilton Hotel. Executive Director of the Alaska Botanical Garden is Julianne McGinnis, sitting next to me. Julianne, how are you doing?
Hi, Steve.
How are you?
Good, doing good.
I'm glad to hear it. And also with me is Leah Wagner, founder of Foundroot, and you were with us last year, I think, right, Leah?
Yeah, right about this time.
Yeah, and we had a fascinating talk. We had Gary Paul Nabhan on, and you had studied with him and talking about saving your seeds. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think we've had you on twice.
Yeah, I've been here a couple times.
Yeah, so that's great. Well, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
And Foundroot is a heritage seed saving institution.
We're a business. We're a small business.
Yeah. And you showed up, I noticed that, I don't know if you just made the Spinard Farmers Market or went to some of the others with your seeds?
Yeah, we go to the Spinard Farmers Market. We did the Palmer Friday fling and then a lot of events, conferences, and festivals throughout all last season. This year, we're a little bit quieter. We're just doing major gardening events. We're searching for land right now, so we're honing back all our operations.
Mm-hmm. But the idea is saving seeds.
Incorporating the idea of the open pollinated, or for lack of a better term, heirloom seed into the home garden. So today talking about the kitchen garden and just keeping seeds in mind as part of that.
And Kelly Ingram, you're the education director of the Botanical Garden?
Yeah, the program director and volunteer coordinator over at the Botanical Garden.
Well, it's great to welcome you to the show for the first time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
This is the biggie of the year, this thing?
It sure is. We have a lot of great speakers, local experts, and of course our keynote who will be joining us here on Talk of Alaska. So we're very excited for the conference this year.
Yeah. And, you know, I was talking about how the thing has grown. And I'm wondering what kind of changes are we seeing in the conference this year compared to last year?
Well, we have quite a few of local experts, as I said. And our keynote is really extraordinary. Many vendors, too, that will be joining us, like Leah. She'll be a vendor at the conference and representing a lot of local businesses who are really thriving in local food and different agricultural businesses as well.
Yeah. How's the food going to be this time around, Julianne?
Delicious, as
really?
Usual.
Oh,
it's so funny. When people fill out surveys, you know, program evaluations of the conference, the number one comment is usually about the food.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, people who garden are, I think,
foodies.
Often very, very food-oriented.
Yeah.
And I know this, one of the things I look forward to most is being able to have the absolute fresh flavor that I can think of an herb and go out there and pick it if I'm lucky enough to have it out there. And
that's right.
Or change my recipe just to accommodate what I do have, when the chives come in or whatever.
And gardeners, growing their own get spoiled because they taste the best. And
indeed.
I know I'm a garlic evangelist and I grow my own garlic. I'd never buy supermarket garlic anymore.
Well, I didn't even know you could do that in Alaska.
Yeah, well, garlic thrives up here.
Well, how do you do it?
How do you plant garlic?
Yeah.
Well, you plant it in the fall. And you select some great heirloom varieties or varieties that you wouldn't commonly see. Up here in the far north, we have to grow Rocambole garlic, hardneck garlic. And you plant it in the fall. You plant it a little deeper than you would if you were living in the lower 48.
So it's like your basic bulb type of
It's a bulb, yeah.
And can you get it year after year? Or?
Well, you harvest your garlic and you save some of it and you replant from what you've saved and over time, you find which varieties do best in your little ecosystem in your own garden.
Indeed.
And yeah, I know I'm partial to some Siberian and Chinese varieties, Chengdu and Siberian and music.
Wow. Mm. Well, let me put out the phone number again, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And you may be wondering what's become of our guest. Roger Dwaran, founder of Kitchen Gardeners International. We have a digital link established, and we are awaiting the final connection of that from Portland, Maine. He lives in Scarborough, which is just outside of Portland, and has come into a digital studio to be on this show before traveling to Alaska and keynoting later this week. So the thing opens on what, Friday, Saturday?
Friday evening. We kick the conference off with Roger's keynote, which is going to be My Subversive Garden Plot.
He's good on those puns, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah. And then all day Saturday, the conference resumes at about 8:30 a.m. on Saturday, and everything is at the Hilton. And we have about, again, this year we have four tracks of about four talks, and as well as another talk by Roger on Saturday. He'll be talking about gardening our way back to the future on Saturday. We have a great array of other talks coming up. We have, in addition to Leah speaking, we have Verna Pratt speaking about native plants for the garden, and Marilyn Barker speaking about Alaska's terrestrial orchids. Dave Ianson will be speaking about rhubarb, Kathy Liska about fruit trees, and Dr. Gary Ferguson will speak about the store outside your door. Lori Constantino will speak about urban foraging. And I'll let Kelly kind of describe a few more.
Yeah, we have talks on composting from Ellen Vandevies. Bill Campbell will be joining us from the Valley to talk about potatoes. Brenda Adams is coming up from the Kenai Peninsula to talk about a ton of things from barks to berries to bulbs. We have some great speakers. Robbie Frankovich from Girdwood will be talking about perennials and keeping blooms in your garden throughout the season. So we're very excited about all these great experts in our community joining us.
And we have one more I wanted to definitely mention. Aisha Gilbert will be speaking about Alaska agricultural enthusiasms and Anchorage's centennial. And she'll give quite an interesting snapshot of the early frontier gardens of Anchorage and the new heritage garden that we're building at the Alaska Botanical Garden in time for the centennial.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Really? So, so who's going to execute that?
We're working on it right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks to a grant from the Alaska Humanities Forum, the Rasmussen Foundation, and the Anchorage Centennial Celebration.
So you're going to put hoops on it, or how are you going to?
No, we have many of the local nurseries and greenhouses are helping us to get the starts ready. So
okay.
That we're, yeah.
Yeah, so you just prepare the ground when it's time to prepare the ground.
Hey there, Roger.
Put everything in there.
Loud.
Mm-hmm.
Hello there. I think I'm hearing our guest now. Is that right?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello, Roger.
Hello.
Roger Dwaran, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you folks?
We're doing really well. People who will be at the Garden Conference and are eagerly awaiting meeting you later this week are here. We've got Leah Wagner of Foundroot. We've got Julianne McGinnis of the Botanical Garden and Kelly Ingram, I think you talked to before.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you, and I'm glad you came. We were just talking about Heritage Gardens, and I think that's a good point to bring up, your White House garden campaign. It's never been clear to me whether Kitchen Gardeners International was actually responsible for there being a garden, a vegetable garden at the White House, or you just had a campaign and they also put one in, but there's not necessarily a causal connection.
Well, I'd like to think there was a causal connection. And I'm getting a bit of a feedback on this.
I hear
so
it.
I'm hearing myself. So I'm not sure if that's something that can be corrected with our tech folks.
Yeah,
it's okay.
It's a delay in the back feed. Go ahead.
It's a delay, exactly. So what I was saying was I'd like to think that there was a bit of a causal link, but in the end, only First Lady Michelle Obama knows what inspired her to plant that garden.
They'll never admit it. That's what you're saying.
Well, I couldn't blame her for not admitting it either, because she deserves a ton of credit, because there were all kinds of different things she could have decided to do with her political capital and goodwill. And it was courageous for her to start digging up a historic landscape, even if it was to sort of turn it back into what it used to look like a couple of hundred years ago. But yeah, we certainly had, I think, a hand in that garden, in the sense that KGI, my organization, organized a campaign over the span of about 14 months. It actually started in the beginning of 2008 when the political candidates were crisscrossing Iowa, and no one was really thinking about the food implications of the next president at that point. But I certainly was, and I just saw that there was an opportunity to be seized to try to introduce some garden talk into the talk that was happening in Iowa at the time, and just as part of the campaign trail. So we did this campaign called Eat the View over the span of 14 months, and just had a ton of fun with it in terms of doing some viral videos to get people excited about the possibility that the next president could plant a garden at the White House. Having a petition drive, we put up a petition on Facebook and had over 100,000 signatures. And at the end of the day, something seems to have worked, whether it was our campaign or just the media attention that it got. But it seems that at some point, the powers that be were able to sort of tune into it. And I think Michelle Obama did actually hear that this was, you know, the voice of the American people that was speaking in a very loud voice, saying, you know, this makes sense again. It made sense before to have food grown at the White House, and we're sort of there again in terms of some of the challenges that we face. So it's just a wonderful thing that she did, and I'm really quite impressed with how the whole project is being managed as well, in terms of the garden being used as sort of a platform for talking about all kinds of other important issues.
Yeah, I think one thing that a lot of listeners, if maybe you're not into gardening, have kind of gotten themselves into micronutrients and probiotics and eat to live or whatever. And the fact of the matter is that for nutritional quality, you really can't beat what you just pulled out of your garden for a lot of reasons.
Exactly. I think that there are new people coming to the garden for that reason. There's certainly all kinds of different things that motivate people to grow their own food. I encounter, as a parent myself, I encounter a lot of parents who, you know, want to expose their children to good eating habits early in life. But there are other people who, as you mentioned, are just so interested in having the healthiest and most vibrant food they can possibly get on their tables. And as you said, you just can't get any fresher than the food you grow yourself.
Yeah, Julianne was telling me how great, if you get the right varieties, how great garlic does up here. And I want to throw another one. Probably the fattiest food I know of right now is kale, which is the least likely, I would think. But let me tell you, pal, kale and turnips. When it comes to kale and turnips, we are king up here. We rule.
One thing that's nice about Alaska is that with our cold weather, all our brassicas, including kale, get a lot sweeter. So our kale actually tastes substantially better than other places.
Yeah.
Oh, I think Maine can give you a run for your money, though. But that's a good competition for states to have. You know, who can have the sweetest brassicas?
Well, Roger, I do think taste really does enter into it, and I'm wondering how things are going in terms of, like, my relatives in northern Pennsylvania are doing a website now and a family heritage garden. They're growing the boutique tomatoes and so forth, and they have a little farmer's market going down at the courthouse once a week, and lately they've been bringing chefs in there, and they found out that that was really a key part of it, and we're kind of getting to that up here in Anchorage, I think, where people come and the vendors spend so much time educating people as to what they can do with the food that they're trying to sell in the few limited hours they have, that they're all the time explaining. We're almost to the point where we want to get chefs there to talk about what can be done with the food so more inventory can get moved at the farmer's market. Yeah, it's great to have a social occasion, but I'm wondering how that works up there in your Scarborough area in Maine.
Well, we also are seeing that chefs are playing a really critical role in terms of pushing the local food movement along. And I think it's one of the things that a lot of people still struggle with. We have a ton of gardeners out there, I'm happy to say, in Maine and across the country. But I think some people still struggle with, you know, what do you do with the kale? What do you do with the turnips and the chard? If you're not sort of coming from a professional culinary background, and that's been really important for me with the work that I've been doing to focus not on the garden solely, but also on the kitchen, to give some educational information about, you know, what to do with this fresh produce. And I think it has been interesting to watch the development of the culinary sector over the past 10, 15 years with the rise of celebrity chefs and the role that they have the potential to play, and in fact that they are playing. I was thinking actually today about some of the things that I was going to mention in one of my talks this weekend, and was looking back at the amazing career of Chef Alice Waters of California.
Oh yeah.
I consider her to be really the mother of the farm-to-table movement in the United States. And, you know, it really takes these sort of charismatic chefs, passionate people who can win people over to the taste of this type of food. So I think, you know, we need a lot more gardeners for sure, but we also need a lot more garden chefs who can sort of seal the deal with the public.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Roger Dwaran is our guest by digital link from Portland, Maine, but he'll be in town as the keynote speaker for the annual garden conference of the Alaska Botanical Garden, which is taking place this weekend at the Hilton in Anchorage. And they always bring in these great speakers. And I want to stop right this minute and thank Julianne McGinnis for that, because I understand you're retiring.
Retiring from this phase of my life.
Yeah.
Moving on later in the season.
I just have to say personally that, of course, you make these people available to us, so we're able to put them on that soapbox, which is really great for me. But you're batting 1,000 in the keynote speakers that you've brought up.
Well, thanks.
And I don't know if anybody's going to be able to do as good a job.
Certainly the Alaska Botanical Garden Conference will go strong each year, so it's part of the fun anticipating who's going to be the next keynote speaker. So looking forward to 2015.
Well, you put a very strong accent on the food security aspect, and there's many other aspects, as you know, to botanical gardening. I mean, you could just bring up some celebrity to talk about ferns, for all I know, that you can't eat it all, as opposed to the ones you can.
Well, and I think that's a reflection of the public, what the public's interested in, and what people, members of the garden and volunteers and gardeners, the gardening community is very interested. As we were talking earlier, so many gardeners are also food people, whether they're foodies and into interesting taste and gourmet food preparation, or food security, or teaching about growing food to children and such. And while many gardeners are also very interested in growing ornamental plants, which we have represented at our conference as well, There's a great blending happening. Food gardening has gotten bigger and bigger. So
yeah, what's wrong with flowers you can eat? And there's also this whole matter of the ecosystem of the forest integrating and all the microbes and so forth.
And biodiversity, cultivating biodiversity. I think that's, for me, one of the most important aspects of kitchen gardening is that instead of cultivating a monoculture, like a single crop or a single variety, you're helping preserve biodiversity in your little corner of the world. So,
well, I'll tell you this, Roger. Our kale is great, but our tomatoes are a bit lacking in Alaska. That's your big deal is figuring out how to extend your season and shelter those nice little tomatoes. They do get cold enough to set the blossoms with no problem at night. Mm-hmm. The problem is rather that the season is just too dang short for it. But I will tell you that my wife's parents, grandparents, had a grape vegetable garden in the Philadelphia area, and they had a patch of tomatoes that was reserved for Bloody Marys. Think of that. I mean, I bring that up in the kitchen gardening context. I think that you probably got some special stuff that you're growing because you like it.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, I grow certain things each year for the pleasure, other things for the challenge. I always make a point of growing different varieties each year just because I think that that's what keeps it fun and interesting is to try new things. But in terms of my challenge list, I'm always going for sort of a proper melon of some sort, which is a challenge in Maine. Tomatoes are a pretty sure thing, when we don't have the late blight come through. No matter what, we should get some decent tomatoes from one year to the next. I just love the sort of the concept of going out to my backyard to do my grocery shopping and having a wide selection of things to choose from.
Well, one thing that you have been pushing is, you call it food sovereignty. I wanted to get you to talk about that a bit. Food sovereignty zones even, food sovereignty ordinances, and so forth like that. What is that?
Well, there are some interesting things happening here in the state of Maine on that, where people are trying to be more self-reliant, in, not only in terms of their food, but also in terms of their governance. And so there have been some pockets of resistance, you might say, in the form of people who have declared or asked their local officials to declare their area's food sovereign in terms of being able to essentially grow the food that you want to grow, produce the food that you want to grow, share it the way that you want to share it, and even sell it the way that you want to sell it without having to jump through a number of bureaucratic hoops. So that's sort of what I've been referring to when I talk about local food sovereignty laws, these people who have, managed to get some legislation through at the local level that allows them to do those things. And in my own hometown, as a matter of fact, in Scarborough, Maine, we've done a little bit of that. We're not exactly on the cutting edge when it comes to that type of legislation. But just over the course of the past couple of years, for example, our town council has passed a law that allows people to sell their backyard produce from their front yard in the form of a sort of a homemade farm stand, you might say. And I even decided to put that law to the test a little bit with my two youngest sons a couple of summers ago. They were a little bit too young to get sort of a proper summer job, but I said to them, if they were willing to have a go at it, I would grow a few extra rows of this or that or the other thing and see what happens. And it turned out to be a really eye-opening experience. We had neighbors sort of turning out that we had never had a chance to meet before. I think my boys ended up making about $600 that summer, which isn't bad for a 12-year-old and I think a 14-year-old at the time. So I think that type of thing is really exciting because it's exciting for a number of different reasons. It's great for a 12-year-old to have some form of income. But what we have to have in mind also is that 12-year-old is going to be, you know, 10 years from now, he's going to be getting out of college and thinking about job opportunities. And, you know, who knows? It might not be my son, but it might be some other 22-year-old who grew up in a garden, maybe sold a few tomatoes from his driveway and says, you know, I kind of like that. And I actually made some money, and it's a good way to earn a living. Because I think the next generation of farmers in the United States, they're probably not actually growing up on farms right now. There's a much better chance that they're actually growing up in an urban or a suburban setting where they're probably having some exposure to a garden. So I think that that's great that these types of laws are allowing people to just sort of get on with things, especially when it comes to something as you know, safe as a carrot or a tomato. It might be, I can understand that, you know, we do need to have some laws in place when it comes to some other processed foods where, you know, we do need to be a little bit more careful about the safety. But, you know, when you're talking about garden-grown produce, we said before, it's the freshest stuff that you can find, but I think it's also some of the safest food out there, too.
You want to let people sell vegetables that have been in the dirt? They've been in the dirt, man. What's the matter? That's not sanitary.
Imagine that without even irradiating them.
Is there currently any blocks in Alaska to that? I don't think there are.
No, yeah. I think the regulations are pretty lenient up here.
Yeah, it seems thankfully. Like that's quite common practice up here. Yeah.
Well, there was an episode where the Muni Health Department came around and did some, you know, cracking down a bit on the farmers market.
I think that was mainly processed foods. And in Anchorage specifically, they don't have the same cottage food laws within the municipality. And so they don't allow baked goods unless they're in a commercial kitchen, which out in the valley and going into other towns, that's a really nice element of the farmer's market that we have.
Pat Yak is answering the phone today and just held up a sign saying okra in Alaska, which I find hard to believe. He's from Arkansas. Anybody heard of growing okra in Alaska?
No, actually, I've been intending to try it, but haven't. It's not.
I think people do it in controlled environments, but not outside.
Okay, if you got it in the greenhouse.
Same as tomatoes. I actually, the first farm I ever worked on was in Alfred, Maine, quite close to Scarborough in Portland. And I remember just rows and rows of gorgeous, huge tomatoes grown completely outdoors. And that's what I always think of in comparing the two climates.
Right.
It's just not possible here. Yeah.
He's smugly smirking at Roger.
I'm sorry. I was actually just fondly thinking of those tomatoes that are ahead of me, maybe.
Well, before we take our little break here, let's go to Rand. Joins the program from Galena. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Rand.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
Just terrific.
I'm really excited to hear what you guys are talking about today because it goes so much in line with some of the things we're trying to do here. In Galena, after the recovery and with our school and stuff, there was kind of a renaissance of gardening before the flood. The local community area for planting got wiped out. But over here around the school, we've been working on the raised beds for a couple of years, and working on a long-term design, having some curriculum. And when I heard you say Alice Waters, I got real excited because she's kind of the lady that I'm trying to pattern everything we're doing here after, growing our own stuff locally, trying to avoid as much. We grew 1,000 pounds of potatoes a couple of years ago, and it really got us off to a big jump start. So to hear you guys talk about that and all the things that you talked about when you talked about food sovereignty and diabetes, health, the trick is getting the kids to eat it. And that's been the part for me as a chef and an educator feeding kids. That's been one of the challenging parts. How do you get kids to eat rutabagas, you know?
Oh, wow. That's a good question.
Kelly's got some insight into that.
Yeah, that is always a challenge. And, I mean, really, do you have the challenge in Alaska is really our growing season is outside of the school year. So a lot of times kids aren't around to be able to actually take part in the planting.
Yeah, but you can root cellar those things till the cows come home.
Oh, yeah. We have a program go ahead. Sorry.
Well, speak of the mashed potatoes. Kids love mashed potatoes. You grow the mashed potatoes and the rutabagas here. The rutabaga. We do quite a bit of stealth cooking. I have a couple excellent chefs that work with me, and we'll hide vegetables in meatloaf. Our meatloaf is over 50% vegetable, and the kids have never really realized it. It tastes good, and they don't know the difference. So
well, we
incorporate
find
a little bit.
We find if the kids grow their own, they really enjoy it.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. We have kids. Well, we have a program that we're working with the Anchorage School District and actually growing in the school since the kids aren't around in the summer. But we have kids trying tons of different kinds of herbs, bok choy, doing all these different taste tests of different mustards. And they get to choose how they want to cook it sometimes. And they'll say, oh, that doesn't taste very good like this. Let's try it this way. And we'll add this, other herb or other seasoning to it to try to make it taste better. And so really giving kids their voice is really important, I think, and giving them a little ownership is something that we found that's really helpful.
Absolutely. And one program that we're working on is called Make Your Own French Fries. And it starts out with seeded sweet potato. We plant it here, and that's how we start making our own fries. So getting the kids to buy into that is part of the challenge, getting them to accept it and go, hey, knowing where their food comes from. And it's exciting out here because so much of our food is flown in, and being able to do some of this self-reliance, I think, is the biggest message that we're teaching with the whole thing, is how to take care of yourself. And it's pretty exciting to hear you folks talking about it.
Rand, it's pretty exciting to hear from you, and I'm glad that the recovery is proceeding in Galena and that there was some gardening ground saved.
Yep, it's been a challenge, but our motto has been, we might have been homeless and for a while, but we're not helpless, and we're getting back on our feet and coming together and trying to make the Galena even a better place. There's still a lot of us that aren't here yet, but we continue to work towards it every day.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, Rand. For Roger, I'll tell you the story of Galena. It's on the Yukon River, and they got some breakup flooding, and the ice came up and basically wiped homes out and killed the electricity. Everybody's freezers with all the wild food they got went bad, and dogs were in great peril, and the sanitation problem doesn't even bear speaking about, but they're on the road to recovery.
That's good to hear.
It is indeed. I want to get to your subject of your school gardens, which I understand you promote. But first, we need to take a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVImaging.com. ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Our guest is Roger Dwaran. He's founder of Kitchen Gardeners International. He joins us by digital link from Portland, Maine, but he's on his way into Anchorage to appear at the Botanical Gardens annual garden conference in Anchorage, Alaska. And Roger, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the farm bill that finally emerged from Congress, or if you're that deep into policy, but it appears to me that they're trying to move a little bit more towards the smaller producers and incentives and hoops and so forth?
They are. I actually used to have a lot of familiarity with the Farm Bill, because I, in a former life, was a Farm Bill organizer. But I haven't tuned into it on this one quite as much. But what I recall from my previous days of working on the Farm Bill is somebody saying that farm bills are never revolutionary, but if they are done right, they're evolutionary. And I think this one takes at least some baby steps in the right direction of more support for small-scale farming. And you were talking before the break about school gardens, and I think that, that's really an area where we could stand to do a lot more investing in, whether it's from our own pocketbooks or from the government tax revenues. But I think that, you know, we're seeing some signs of progress on the federal and state level, just because, as was mentioned before, you know, this is what the people want. So we get to vote for this type of expenditure.
Well, as we heard from Galena, they're looking at it purely as a food security situation and a health situation and a self-sufficiency situation. This is a town in trouble, and this is an important thing that they can do, that the school can do, to make for better nutrition and so forth.
I think something that was mentioned earlier that's pretty crucial is the fact that I myself did not grow up with a home garden. I didn't grow up even near any farms in Phoenix, Arizona, cement land. And I think just having a consciousness and an understanding that carrots do come from the dirt and they do grow underground, and understanding what part of the plant that we eat just brings kids that much closer to understanding why they might want to not only eat vegetables but grow them in the future. Whether or not we actually have farmers, we can spread the idea of home gardening at a very young age.
Yeah. So I saw that you got a space on your website, Roger, for grants. How does that work?
Well, it started actually with a couple years ago. I gave a TEDx talk, and some people actually decided to watch it online, and one of the folks who decided to watch it was this generous person who runs a little seed company called the Ark Institute, who said, you know, it sounds like you're doing some good work, Roger. I'd like to donate some seeds to you, for redistributing through your KGI network. And I said, you know, awesome. We'd love to have some seeds, thinking that he was going to offer up, you know, $100 worth of seeds or something like that. And he said, no, I had something a little bit bigger in mind, like, you know, a couple $1,000 worth of seeds. And so I said, well, that's a really good problem to have here. Let me think about how we could actually accept a donation of so many seeds. And so I decided to sort of invent a new program called Sow It Forward, which is our mini grants program built around that initial seed donation. And so this is only our second year of doing this, but last year, in our first year, we were able to give out 80 grants of seeds, cash, supplies, some books. And this year, we've been, thanks to some donors, we've been able to double that to 160 grants, and we're looking to double it again next year. So there are a lot of school garden projects in there. There are community gardens. There are senior gardens. There are tribal gardens, and all kinds of garden projects that you could never really imagine, but you're very thankful to find out that they're out there. There are prison gardens. There are interesting sort of hybrid projects where it might be a garden that's grown at a school, for example, but where the produce is being donated to a food bank, and where there are some senior citizens from the community who are involved as volunteers. So it just is really quite refreshing to discover just how much good work is going on at the local level. But that work does need to be supported somehow, and we're doing our best to try to get some resources to those people.
Neat. Ellie joins the program from Talkeetna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ellie.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for letting me on here. I really enjoy your garden show every spring and look forward to it. Calling from up here in Talkeetna, we have a very dynamic, what I call a subsistence gardening community up here, and people do a lot of trading of starts back and forth. But the reason I'm calling is 3 years ago, I had a problem with an herbicide contamination in my garden. And I know a lot of us use animal manure to put in our gardens for fertilizer. And I just happened to get a hold of some manure from a neighbor that apparently the hay that they had been feeding to the animals, whoever was growing the hay had used an herbicide on the hay, and it had gone right through the animals and right into my garden. So wanted to give your all the listeners on this program a heads up. If you're using animal manure, make sure it is well composted and might not hurt to check it out ahead of time, plant something in it before you actually put it through your whole garden. It's been 3 years now that I'm hoping to get back to a normal year this year, but it's been quite the challenge.
Wow.
That's terrible to hear.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah. And sounds like it's a little more common these days. I've been working with Steve Seafelt, who is the extension agent from up in Fairbanks, and sent photos of my injured plants to him, and he was the one that diagnosed the problem. And so he recommended that it's bacterial action that will break down these chemicals that's in the manure. So sounds like a couple of years of composting on the manure before you put it in the garden definitely is in order. And there are certain of the garden plants that are more sensitive to this stuff than others are. I noticed with things like the beans and peas and marigolds, definitely were hit the hardest by this stuff. And,
oh, that hurts.
Yep, but just about wiped them out. The tomatoes and potatoes got hit, but it didn't kill them. Mm. And here I am 3 years later. It's working through the system. All the soil microbes are working, and last year was a big improvement in the garden over the previous year. And I'm hoping this year will be even better, and I'll be back to normal. But watch out, folks. This stuff is out there, and it may get into your garden.
Okay, Ellie, I hope I get an update from you next year.
Yep, we'll see how it goes, and I'll keep my fingers crossed for this year.
Roger, do you ever hear a problem like that?
I haven't encountered something like that personally, but yeah, I mean, there are issues like that, you know, with soil contamination. You know, one of the things that concerns me the most, especially with new gardeners in urban and suburban areas, is, you know, the possibility of lead contamination in soil. So many people are so enthusiastic about getting out and growing some of their own, but you do have to proceed with a little bit of caution. If you're starting to plant in a new area, you know, make sure you get your soil tested. But it sounds like that particular situation just sounds like some really bad luck. And but I think the caller did well to just alert people that they need to, you know, pay attention to what's going into their gardens. You know, ask those additional questions if you can. And if the other person is honest enough to tell you what, you know, what the story of that hay is. But I think you do need to show some caution.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Calls are toll free. We've got three people from the Alaska, well, two from the Alaska Botanical Garden, one from Found Root, which is a seed saving outfit, and a very interesting way of approaching food security with using open pollinated seeds. And Roger Dwaran, founder of Kitchen Gardeners International, is coming up for the garden conference this year. So I wanted to go back to these heritage gardens. When you were campaigning to get a vegetable garden in the White House lawn, which did happen, not the front lawn, I guess, but at least it happened, you pointed to Victory Gardens and said that 40% of our fruits and vegetables at one point during the war were coming from Victory Gardens. I was floored by that.
Yeah, it's hard to believe if you think about we don't really even collect data like that anymore, so we don't really have a good sense of where we are right now. But, you know, if we're even at 3% or 5% right now, I'd be surprised. So, you know, I decided to embrace the Victory Garden term when we were doing our campaign just because I felt like it was something that a lot of people could connect with. And you know, I think one of the great themes of kitchen gardens or food gardens is that they allow us to connect with our past, allow us to connect with our heritage. And although there are a lot of folks who might not have grown up in a garden themselves, they probably have a parent or a grandparent who did. So it offers that connection with our own family, with some of our own food traditions. So I think that was something that sort of worked with our campaign when we did our campaign for the garden at the White House, just to align ourselves with our agricultural heritage, our horticultural heritage, which is a very rich one. And, you know, just to share a couple of things, the original first gardener, you might say, was John Adams in the year 1800 when he, you know, moved into the White House. And it was just the normal, natural thing that a president would grow some of his own food at that time. So it's an interesting voyage that we've been on to see, you know, where we started, where we are now. And all kinds of edibles have been planted at the White House over the course of its history. The last victory garden planted there was in 1943 by Eleanor Roosevelt. And it was actually considerably smaller than the one that we have there now. But it also had its impact. That was, of course, during World War II, and it had a great symbolic impact on the American people. And I think the current garden is doing that as well, but just perhaps inspiring people to garden for different reasons. We're not, unfortunately, we're not at war with any other countries right now, but I think we are sort of at war with the environment and at war with our own health. And I think the garden is going to help us win those wars.
So did the White House ever get in touch with you at all? I mean, just to say thanks for pushing for this or, you know, that's the chef may be saying, wow, that really helps the menu or anything like that.
Well, I did actually get I got in touch with them. It the story of this is that when the Obama family moved into the White House at the end of January 2009, at that point, our campaign really was sort of at its peak in terms of the attention that it was getting, in terms of the number of people who were signed on to our petition. And I said to myself, you know, it's really important now that the right people sort of sign on to this. We've got all these great American citizens signed on. All that we're sort of lacking are a couple of signatures in the form of the president and first lady. But I didn't, you know, I'm not a mover and a shaker who's hanging out in the corridors of power anywhere, not even in my own house.
Very good.
So I said to myself, you know, how am I going to get this to the right people? And I tried to, you know, use the little network that I had in terms of the powerful people that I'm connected with, but I didn't really have any direct links. And so what I ended up doing was I just picked up the telephone and I called the White House switchboard and I asked to be put through to a woman by the name of Jocelyn Fry, who was and I think continues to be First Lady Obama's policy director. And I think it was because it was so early on in the Obama administration, they didn't have their firewalls in place, but I got put through. I got put through immediately to Jocelyn Fry, and I introduced myself and I said, you know, I'm not sure if you've taken note, but there are a lot of people across the country who would like to see the First Lady plant a garden at the White House, and she said, oh no, we're very aware of you and what you've been up to, She said, we would like to have, you know, a conversation or two with you. So I ended up having a couple of conversations with members of the Obama team, but they were not. They were sort of in, just sort of standing back and listening a lot to what I had to say. I think they really wanted to know what I was sort of hearing from the ground up. You know, what was the level of support? Was I hearing some backlash about the campaign? And of course, there were some people who didn't like the idea of, you know, the White House lawn getting altered in any form. For them, you know, the White House is meant to look a particular way. But even those people, I think, did sort of come around later when, you know, they found out that what we were talking about doing was actually returning the White House grounds to its original splendor. But yes, so there was some back and forth for a couple of weeks with the Obama administration. But I learned the news of the garden going in the same way that everybody else did. There wasn't sort of an advance call to me. I just remember, you know, turning on my computer, going to the New York Times on March 20th, 2009, and seeing that that announcement that the First Lady was going to be out on the front lawn. And in a way, Steve, the South Lawn is the front lawn of the White House. I've thought about this a little bit because it's through the South Lawn entrance that the heads of state arrive at the White House. So I would call that our front lawn.
The veggie greeting.
Yeah.
We're talking to Roger Dwaran as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
We're talking about gardening again on Talk of Alaska. It's the Alaska Botanical Gardens Annual Garden Conference. It's at the Hilton this year in Anchorage. It's grown. Is there any risk that, Kelly, that it might sell out this year?
Oh, that would be lovely, but we're very excited to be at the Hilton. It has room for us to grow in future years, so but everyone is welcome to come. That's the more the merrier. So
when we do membership drive and there's no telephones ringing, we say, well, there is a line available for you right now. Thanks. Thanks. Leif joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Leif.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question for the folks on the show about deck gardens. It's probably a question that would be pertinent to urban and suburban people that want a garden, but I don't have that excuse. I'm a lazy person, and I want to build a deck garden so that I don't have to weed, and I would like to set it up so that I don't have to water either, so I could go on a canoe trip for a week and come back to fresh.
I think this is all very doable. Roger, you want to give him a little advice maybe?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure how much of a engineer, professional, or amateur you are, but there are definitely ways to do the things that you're talking about doing. I think a deck garden is a great place to start for a lot of people. You do need to think. I think one of the things that I talk about when I mention kitchen garden is that you want to think of something that's extremely convenient for you. And the closer to the kitchen you can get it, the better, because the easier it is for you to get into the garden, the easier it is for you to get good things out of it. So, deck gardens are certainly great things, and there are some amazing projects happening in the United States and around the world where people are planting things on decks and planting balconies. There's this one gardener that I have been in touch with through the internet who runs a website called verticalveg.com out of the UK, where he's been growing just hundreds and hundreds of pounds on a 5-foot by 9-foot balcony. So they're just, you can really, push the envelope pretty much as far as you want to here.
Wow, that's kind of what I'm thinking about. There's so many good farmers up in Fairbanks. They're great produce here, so I buy a lot of the stuff. But I'd like to have, certain things like arugula and some herbs and maybe a few tomatoes or a pepper or something. But yeah, that would be great if there's some designs online that I could look. I haven't started the design phase yet. I love to tinker it with stuff.
Yeah, I think you're going to need some kind of trickle system if you plan on leaving, because they do dry out.
Well, what I was thinking, I've heard of a system where you either have sand or something that elevates the soil above the water table.
Uh-huh.
But you just keep a constant level, so I could have it like a, like your toilet plunger system, where it just keeps a steady state of water underneath the soil. Is there something like that?
There are a lot of people do it with tomatoes because they like to be bottom watered, and so It's a Rubbermaid system. I forget exactly. There's a few different terms for it. But what you do is you're literally drilling holes in a Rubbermaid and nestling them inside each other. And what that does is it allows the soil to soak up through the bottom. And usually people just use a water bottle or something clear at the top so they can see when the water level goes down. And it depends on how hot a season we have, which is always a variable. It also depends on what vegetable you're growing and how much they're going to need. But as long as the container is large enough for the plant, I don't see why you couldn't still go on those kayak trips and use a system such as that. But what Steve was mentioning is that a drip line system would definitely be the most consistent. So if you wanted to do some containers, raised beds, things like that, and run drip line on a timer, that would definitely be a quick and easy way to make sure that your plants are staying alive while you're gone.
Yeah, that sounds good. Any other websites I should think about? Verticalveg.com.
You can also look up stuff about square foot gardening. That might be good if you decide to build some raised beds on the deck. That would be easier for the drip line and a little bit more sustainable if you want to continue doing this year after year. It's definitely a lot of labor to fill all those buckets and containers.
Mm-hmm.
Leif, I want to thank you for your call from Fairbanks and try to get one more in. Jacob in Fairbanks is concerned with fruit exploration. Jacob, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
When I was young, we bought an apple tree from University of Alaska. It was engineered for the cold weather, and I think they spliced it with another fruit, but that gave a pretty good bounty. And I don't know how far in the future I'm going to have for maybe orchards in Alaska.
Good point. I think what they do is they graft on a crab apple stock.
It's a Siberian crab apple. And there's quite a few orchards out in the valley. They just don't publicize. But we've been able to buy. Well, you can't. The apples that grow up here, you can't really store the normal way. You can't really put them in a root cellar or anything like that. Maybe for a little while. But they're too tender flesh and small. But we freeze ours and make a lot of fun things out of them. And we've been able to get a really, really nice bounty from some orchards in the Palmer area.
You might look at the Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers Association's website. They might have some tips and resources.
Yeah, I know there are people that are just complete nuts about trying to get good apples going in Alaska.
Yeah, and they've had great success.
Yeah, and if you microclimate is really counts as well. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not so much up in Fairbanks, but as you go a little further south.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob, thanks for your call.
No problem. And another thing, what about grapes?
Ah, grapes. There's a lot of research being done by University of Minnesota on grape, far northern grape varieties, and we're interested in exploring some research up here.
We're out of time. I want to thank all of our guests. Roger Dwaran, I look forward to meeting you. Leah, good to see you again. Mm-hmm. And back next year with more of that. Next week, we're going to talk about the Exxon Valdez spill again. 25 years it's been. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.